Hello, today is June 16th, 2009, and we are in Natick, Massachusetts. And this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Joan Craig. Our cameraman today is Dan McDermott from Natick Pegasus. And we are privileged to have with us today Joseph A. Todisco. Welcome, Joe. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
May I ask you when and where you were born?
I was born at the Boston Lion Inn and on March 17, 1919. So I consider myself a pure of the other people that are born on that date, see.
So
the Irish people. I tell them that Irish people are those that are born on the 17th. We're liberal. We allow everybody else to become Irish if they want to be.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And did you grow up in the Boston area?
East Boston.
In East Boston.
East Boston.
And where are you currently living?
I'm currently living on Walnut Avenue here in Natick.
And how long have you lived in Natick?
We came up here in 1964.
Have you seen a lot of changes in Natick since you came here?
A lot of lousy ones, too, let me tell you.
In what way?
Well, take a look at what you see. Traffic.
A lot of traffic.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go back over that where I was going to the... every time they had a hearing on that, I would appear and tell them how lousy that would be, you know.
The traffic would be worse.
Well, take a look at it.
It is very busy, isn't it?
Because they didn't realize that Route 9, okay, when, of course, they weren't born at that time, so they don't know anything about history. But it was built to take 40,000 motor vehicles a day, see. On the day that the state turned it over to the people, it meant 40,000. That was it. They expected time, but just on that day.
And it kept
building up.
It's a lot more than that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. In fact, I don't live too far away from it. It's just my land. The other person's house was on the thing. And although we can't go out there and have a barbecue anymore because...
On your land?
Yeah, because of the noise.
The noise from
can't even hear yourself talk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you married?
Yeah.
How long have you been married?
It'll be 65. Will be 66 come July 4th.
66 years. Congratulations.
On the 4th of July.
On the 4th. So you were born on St. Patty's Day and you get married on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
That's unique.
Well, let me put it to you this way, as unique as it is, that happened to be a situation where I got getting a vacation from the Army, see. So the first time I went, it was as cold as blazes, the coldest weather they had at that time, see. We couldn't even go out, we'd freeze, no matter how well you were dressed. And after that, I went back and I told the person that takes the evidence of whatever you're doing when you walk in and out. And I says, look, I says, I got a deal that I got to get married on. So I want to know when I can get my next vacation and go. Because I wanted to get married, so
your
I did.
Your next leave?
It was on the next leave, on the 4th of July.
And do you have children?
I have a son and a grandson and a daughter.
And where and when did you enter the military?
I gave you that date, I believe.
Yes, it says here, March of 1942.
Yeah.
And where did you enter?
We entered it from this section here, where the government has
the armory.
Where they're looking into things that they can do for improving stuff, way on the other end.
What town?
It was in this town there, where was the receiving area for everybody.
Like a depot?
Yeah.
In Natick?
In Natick. Well, all over the other side of Natick.
Framingham?
Not Framingham. It was just...
But in this Metro West area?
Yeah, in the Metro West area.
Okay.
And we got there. We stayed, I think it was a couple of days. And then we boarded a train.
And why...
And traveled all night.
Why did you decide to join in March of 1942?
I didn't decide. I got called. We all had to sign up.
So you got called up.
Yeah.
How old were you at that time? About how old?
Let's see, 19, 20, 20, about 22 years old.
And between high school and 22 years before you got called up, were you working or were you continuing your education? What were you doing at that time?
I was doing both. I was working. And on the days off, I would go to a college and take lessons.
Some college courses?
Yes.
And where were you working?
I was working at the Walt Dam Boys Club at that time.
And what was your job at the Boys Club?
I was an employee there that eventually became the assistant director.
And what college were you taking courses, do you remember?
It was named after a president. I forgot now, but today, it's the Boston School of Law.
Boston School of Law.
That's what it became, and the thing, and that's where I graduated. When I went back, I had to leave to do my duty, and then. When I got discharged, my wife said, you have enough credits, why don't you become a lawyer?
We'll get to that in a little bit. What branch did you join, and did you have a choice in what branch?
Absolutely not. You went where they told you to go.
And what branch did they tell you were going to?
The Army.
The Army.
Yeah.
And did you have friends that were going with you at the same time? Or family members?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall on that. Eventually, I ran into friends that lived right by my...
Near your home?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was after we had my, where I got my uniform and things like that.
And you said then you got on a train.
Yeah.
And where did you go on the train? Do you remember?
Virginia.
And did you go to Virginia for basic training?
Basic training on artillery.
On artillery. Had you ever handled...
That was 155, big guns. Oh, big artillery. You call it a gun, you'd get...
But it was really more... It almost
was
like a cannon, or...
Well, that's what it was.
It was a cannon.
But they didn't want to call it a cannon. It was an artillery piece. A 155, it was, the ball was about from here to there.
So a good 8 feet.
It was a, let's put it this way, that in order to fire that cannon, it took a number of men to do it. You had two men sitting on top of that. One getting information from one section and another section so that they could elevate and turn that cannon around. And there was the first, the person who had the lighter there that had two men that had to carry a 90-pound round, and somebody else, and they had a somebody else running beside them once they set it to push it in.
Push it in, right.
And then another person running with 20 pounds of powder.
My goodness.
And the thing, when we went there, those cannons were, they weren't up to date. The enemy had better, things that... Motor vehicles that ran better than ours, I mean faster, and the same way with the carriages of the artillery, you see. So they took it out, and they brought it back again, and it was all so that it could go 40 miles per hour instead of 10 as the NW1.
So before we get into that, along with artillery guns, what other type of basic training were you doing at that time?
Well, we were basic training and marching and getting in shape. So in the morning, when you woke up after breakfast, you would go out and you'd see this section of metal that was going up and so forth, and the you had to jump up there and grab one thing and keep going on it that way to get in shape.
See? And were you in good shape to do that, or was it tough for you?
I was in good shape. I could also get in the square aprons and throw a lot of pounds, a lot of punches.
What do you mean by square aprons?
A ring?
Boxing. Were you a boxer before?
Or? Well, I was being trained for that, yeah, and I played football. And we played football. We didn't have the, this was during the Depression. We take a bag, stuff it up with papers, and that's how we played football. And at that time, they had what they call a flying thing. You could jump at a fellow that was running away with the ball and knock him down. A lot of them got hurt that way, sure. Even the professions. Yeah. And we did that on the street where it wasn't tarred or anything. It just had those nice bricks on that. Not bricks, but they were rounded.
Boulders, yeah. And you would fall on
them? Yeah, we'd fall
so
on that.
So you were pretty tough.
Huh?
You were pretty tough.
Oh, yeah.
So during basic,
in
was
fact,
it during...
In fact, when I go for a haircut, they said, boy, he said, what the heck, you got all of those marks on your head and stuff. I said, those were the rocks that bounced there when we were throwing rocks at each other.
Now, in the Army, and they knew you were a boxer, did you do that in your spare time while you were in the Army also?
Doing what?
Boxing?
No.
Or was
no,
just before?
No, that was your time in the Army. It was all taken care of by the captain and whatever he had to do, and the lieutenant and the sergeant.
So after Virginia in basic training, then... And you had already heard about what was happening in the war overseas.
Yeah.
So after Virginia, where did
you go?
Well,
in fact, we had a nice captain over there the first time. He had been in the Army for quite a while. He was an elderly individual, but he was a wonderful captain, the best I ever had. Because there was a man there, he would not ask you to do anything that he himself wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come on the marches with us when we had to go climb on those things and, you know, go out. He'd be the first there. Yeah, he'd be the first.
Too.
Yeah, the first to do it.
And how long were you in?
Of course, he didn't win the lieutenants that he had. In fact, that's how they got rid of him with the colonel.
Because they didn't want to have to do it?
Well, you see, there were... Four units there of 250 men, mm-hmm. plus lieutenants and a captain and other people. And, you know, we bragged about what he was, how wonderful he was compared to the other the thing. So it went, you know, it didn't sit well with the other officers.
So then after that he was gone?
They transferred him someplace else, yeah.
And after Virginia...
Georgia.
And what did you do in Georgia?
The same thing. We, mm-hmm. You know, had additional training where we dug foxholes and things of that nature. See.
And how long were you in Georgia?
Quite a while. I didn't keep track of that, mm-hmm. but we were there quite a while before we moved again, and we moved down to Florida.
Down to Florida.
Down to Florida at that. And we were, my view, whatever somebody else might want to think about it, sidetracked because they said that what we were going to do was to help write from land to air defense. So we got electric big units to look at the enemy airplanes coming around during the evening, see, with the gadgets where we could take it and follow them all the way around.
Almost like radar?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was before radar. It came in shortly after that.
So were there maps of some sort also that you had to learn?
No maps. No. Just go out there at nighttime, and you wait until our own people were coming by where we were training, see? Yeah. In fact, the first night that we were up there, I was the other three units were all out there. Mm-hmm. And I was the first one that gave the signal to turn the light on, and there it was, that airplane right in the middle. Somebody says, "Who did that?"
So you were basically tracking the enemy?
Well,
learning
how to do it, yeah.
And then after Florida, what did you do?
After Florida, we went to Australia.
And
I had two Sundays. We went over the line.
Oh, you did. Did you have any kind of a ceremony going
the,
on
the
your way
Navy
to Australia?
Did, not us. The Navy. And oh, they were rough.
And were you going over by ship?
Yeah.
And what was it like for you going on a ship for that length of time? In previous interviews, some of the gentlemen have said they didn't have a problem, whereas others were very sick. How about you?
I wasn't.
You weren't sick. No. So.
Well, because you see, I in East Boston, we used to go on the ferry boat, and no matter what it was, you got trained in a sense, so that, you know.
So when you were going over to Australia, did they explain to you why you were going?
No.
And once you got there, did you have additional training?
Yeah.
And what kind of training and was that?
We got the natural training that we had right along. You did exercises with your rifles. You went out there and fired your rifles, and you would get what you were doing, how many times you hit the center of.
And were you good at on the range, on the rifle range?
Oh yeah, we had nice time on that.
Did they give you information about what you were going to face and what kind of enemy you were going to face?
We not only got to face on that, told about it, we were informed even when we sat with the group, and they told us. And in fact, our first captain that we had would call us in the morning. We'd sit around him, and he'd explain what was going on. And he talked to me once because he said, "Do you know?" You know, he said, "Well, do you know where this country is and that country?" See, and I was well trained on that. He said, "Yeah." So he says, "You will give the lectures every morning."
So, and was he talking about Asia at that time?
Not at Asia at that time. This was mostly what was in the thing was Europe.
And at the time, did you think you would be going to Europe, or did you feel?
Not when I went to Australia. I knew that we weren't going to go to the thing. I was hoping I went to Europe because I had my grandfathers there and my grandmothers.
They were in
Italy? In
Italy,
yeah.
But instead you got sent south.
Yeah. And we had trouble there in Australia because we didn't get along very well with the Australian men.
Why? Why is that? Because you were handsome young men? And there were a lot of women, or was it?
Well, let's put it this way: there were they had their army too that was out. I mean, the fact is that we were well paid,
I see.
They weren't.
Okay.
So actually, their girls wanted to come with us because we could give them a better time.
And were you able to socialize with the girls over there in your free time?
Yeah, a lot of them could. I didn't. I was married at that time.
You were already married before you went over.
That's right.
Okay, because you had said earlier that you wanted to take some time off to get married. What was Australia like for a boy coming from the city?
Well, it was one of those things that was a lot different in the they spoke English, but the English was a little different, like the English you would hear from that in England,
sure. See?
And their methods of doing it, and they ate well. And in fact, the you could go to a restaurant over there, and a little or nothing is what you would pay for it. In fact, I remembered going where I said, gee, look at those peaches. I says, I think I better buy a dozen of them. And I asked, he said, we don't sell them by the dozen. I said, what are you selling them? He says, buy a number 8 bag. I said, give me a, what a bag.
A number 8 bag?
Yeah, for 25 cents, you should see what I got.
Sure.
I had, I couldn't eat all that. All I wanted was a few, so I, you know, saw the guys coming. I says, here, help yourself.
Were you in a camp in Australia?
Yeah, we had a section, yeah, that we were in. It was ours, yeah.
And so daily you would do some training?
We would do training every day, and then toward the evening time you would have off.
So have some free time in the evening.
Yeah, so you could go to the movies and mm-hmm. things like that. Or you would have, you know, our own people coming in from California and then because that's where we bounced off from California to get to Australia.
So you had mentioned earlier before we went on tape about some of the training and some of your other Army soldiers sort of holding back from training. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it wasn't holding back. It was just the fact of thinking of what you had to do that was, you know, something you never thought of doing. I mean, you look, there's a man there, okay? And you're going, you're saying you got to go up to him, and if you have to strangle him, if you have to put your, you know, shove your gun into him or shoot him in the eye or whatever, you know, something you never did. So, you know, that was to say, you know, that's a human being. You know, I'm not hunting animals. And so you'd hold back a bit.
And what would they say to some of those who would hold back?
Oh, you get blasted for that. You mm-hmm. get blasted for that. And some of them, if you hesitated too long, you'll be doing that at night.
and there would be a concern that if you didn't protect yourself, that you would be dead.
Absolutely. That's what happened, let me tell you.
Sure, sure. So how long were you stationed in Australia?
I don't know. It was quite a bit of time on that. I think we probably spent about 4 or 5 months, maybe even more.
And during that time, did you see any soldiers coming back from combat who were then going home? And were you able to talk to them at all?
No, okay. No. If they were coming back, at least from what we saw, what I figured out was that anybody coming back again that was in bad shape, they weren't going to let you look at him and
or
say,
talk
hey.
To them. Mm-hmm.
Well, they were afraid you might say goodbye. They have to come hunting for you.
Sure. And after Australia...
You know, they had police there, the...
MPs?
The MPs, yeah. If you didn't come back, in fact, I sent one of my friends to my parents and my in-laws, see? He loved us so much, he didn't want to go back, see? But my father-in-law, who was a W-1 individual.
World War I?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talked to him and told him, look, you know, if you don't go back, they come hunting for you and so forth and et cetera. And besides, you got friends that are doing their duties, and I talked to them, and he went back. He went back.
There's always that fear of what they were anticipating happening.
Well, in his, I don't know. It's a fact was that I think he was very enjoyed with what he was eating and being treated. So
had a comfortable life.
He had a very comfortable life there. Sure. They gave him the, you know, the run of the thing. So
sure.
It was fun because he came from a place where. It was tough for him.
So for your 4 or 5 months in Australia, were you training that whole time?
You trained all the time. Mm-hmm. You trained all the time. You know, there's nothing that, you know, you just couldn't go and say, well, I'm going to take the day off. No such thing.
And were you hearing during that time about other aspects of the war, such as in Europe or other areas?
Absolutely. They were very, very, letting you know what they want, and telling you what happened, and getting magazines, welcoming the magazines. The papers coming from home.
See? People would send you papers from
home? Oh, sure. Magazines and stuff like that, yeah. I mean, that's one thing, they never bothered with you. And not only that, but you had your radio in the evening, we're told what happened, in Europe and in Asia and so forth. They made sure that you knew what was going on.
And so did you anticipate that eventually you would be a part of this?
Absolutely. That was the purpose you were there for.
And were you looking forward to, after 4 or 5 months, to get into combat, or were you nervous about having to get back in?
Well, let's say this. As you went through the training, and part of the training, when I said you dug foxholes, well, not only that, but they would tell you, now you're getting in that hole, don't lift your head up or anything, because we're going to show you what it's like. And there'd be a group there firing rounds at you. Your thing going like bees, zing, zing, zing.
So they're also showing you what the sounds were like too, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Not only the sound of a bomb going off, or a hand grenade, because you practice with them, or you take it out and throw it, and
And when you did that for practice, you were using live ammunition?
Yeah. Mm.
Were there any casualties during training?
Only one that I know of. That's when we were in the foxhole, and he evidently lifted his leg going up there, and one of the rounds hit him. That's the only one that I know of. See?
Did he survive?
Oh, yeah. It was only, just something that would heal for him, and he would be back after he recovered and so forth. See? We did things like... When I talk about the where we were training from land to air, they were writing what we were doing, so they would know how to defend all over the place, not only the thing like that. And eventually we got into New Guinea.
And after Australia, you went to New Guinea?
Oh, that was a jumping off place for New Guinea.
And what was New Guinea like?
Well, it was beautiful land. It was a big island is what it was, and a lot of trees there that you could get lost in. See, in fact, and the natives, and a lot of coconut trees that were, and different kinds of fruit.
And were you going to see combat in New Guinea, or did you know?
We didn't know what we were going to see. They never told you. When you got there, you got there, see?
And how did you get there? By ship also?
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's the distance from Australia? Mm-hmm. And once you got there, we got there when it was pretty well cleaned. If there were any Japanese in there, I think the whoever was in charge let the natives take care of them.
So you didn't see any combat in New Guinea?
No.
And
that was the end of it, because we stayed there quite a long time, and what we assumed was that any Japanese, just one section we did, we set up machine guns, because there were noticed that there was a number of them there, and we figured that at night they would come charging. See, so we had sections that, like, I would spend 2 hours there with the machine guns, and somebody else would come to receive, so forth, and nothing happened. I think the natives
were the natives helpful to the Americans?
Well, I don't know how you want to say helpful. They were wonderful people. They had their own way. The Australians were running that, but they were letting them run the way they wanted to live. They didn't bother with them or anything else like that. You could make friends with them. I did. And the man introduced me to his family. He says, all my wives. He had about six or seven.
Six or seven wives?
And a crowd of, yeah, kids too.
And a lot of kids.
Yeah, because it was funny. We were in this section. We see in the natives come, see? But what one of the sergeant wanted to do was to go into their where they were living, mm-hmm. and see if we could get things that you could keep as souvenirs, see? Mm-hmm. So they would follow them, but they would lose them in the jungle.
Because the natives were
well,
so
knew
good,
that they would
knew
be
where they were going. Yeah,
they knew their ways around, they would lose them, see?
Sure.
And of course, it was on the side there, one side was this river. You could walk in it, see? Except when it began to rain, it was about 8 feet high.
Were they monsoon type of rains?
It rained. Let me put it this way: we for a while, see the what we did was the water. You could wade in it, you know, up to ankle, and decided that we'd have fix things around, figure so that we can get water in there and go swimming in the thing. See. So it was a bad storm one night, and we heard this boom, see? We woke up in the morning, and our swimming thing was all spread all over the place. We look at the water, was about 8 feet high.
You had made sort of a swimming hole?
Yeah.
Wow.
It wasn't a swimming hole. It was on top of the thing. It just blew. And it even ruined some of the... whatever you want to call it, their trees that were bearing fruit and stuff like that, they came down.
They came down because of the high winds?
The water pounded them down just around the edge.
The
natives were upset about that because, you know, their banana places and thing had come down. They'd have to wait now for another section, another time when...
Another season?
Yeah.
Because their crop was ruined?
Yeah, the only thing that stood up were the coconuts. And you should see them go up there. They put one of these big knives, I forgot what they called them, put it in their mouth, and they grab the trees, and then they come with their thing, they come up there, get up there, hug it, and come down, and they bounce. See?
The large knife.
Well, a large knife, yeah. They had one that you could hold it in your hand and knock somebody's... Just one whack off, you could knock his neck off or her neck off.
But that didn't happen.
No. Yeah. The thing is, we got excited there in one section there where we hit gunfire, see? And we ran for our rifles and everything else, but it didn't last long. And
was it Japanese?
No. It was our own. You know, Americans are very, what do you want to say? You can do this. These Southern boys finally got to the point where they were able to take the coconuts and milk that was in there turned that to liquor.
Oh.
See? And so there were two sections in there. And they sold it. All right? So one section lowered its amount that they were charging, and the other section got ticked off, so they went and started to shoot the other place.
So there was a little in-house rivalry?
Yeah. Actually, we thought we'd have to go, you know, up, but no.
But it was okay.
Yeah, it was okay, and when it was found out, both things were canceled.
Now, did you go to the Philippines also?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
After New Guinea?
After New Guinea, yeah.
How did they tell you on a daily basis, or did they say, okay, next week we're leaving for, how did they tell you you were going, or you just...
No. You just get called out, and either called out by the sergeant yelling, you know, all hands and so forth and et cetera. And or you would have a notice too that you were going to get out of there somewhere, no matter where you were. You would be told, pack up all your things. You pack them up there, whatever you had to take would be there. But they would never tell you what date you were going to move out of there.
And so suddenly they're telling you to pack up.
Yeah, to pick up your packs and move.
And you didn't know where you were going to go, but you ended up going to
when you got aboard, you would know. Once you got aboard, you would know.
And then would they explain what you were going to be in store for? Or?
Nothing at all. Nothing. Like that. Not just.
So you went then to the Philippines.
Well, in the Philippines, we had a got hit by the end of a storm in there where the boat started the ship began going, taking water on, you know, washing it on. We had to go down to hold, see, and they got all of us up. Only the sailors were up there, and then going down on the stairway and stuff like that. They had that covered. Nobody could get up. We all had to stay down there, you know. And of course, the ship was going up, bank this way, that way, and I hear the bang, bang, bang. I says, "What's that banging on there?" I said, "What did they put on the there? Anybody see it?" You know, we talk. Someone says, "Yeah." I said, "What?" He says, 50-gallon cans of motor oil and bombs. I said, "Oh, that's all we need." He said, "What do you mean?" I says, "One spark." I said, "We're gonna fly."
Was it scary though for all of you being down there in this storm?
It was a little uncomfortable.
Thinking here we are supposedly in war, and
you couldn't see anything. That was bothering you because what was bothering was this bang, bang, bang as the ship went back and forth.
As it went back and forth
like that.
Yeah. How long did that last?
I have no idea. It was some kind that
sometimes.
Yeah, that was That was the end of the. Storm.
The end of the storm.
Oh yeah, the waves were coming all over. You know, the ship was taking water.
Do you remember where in the Philippines you landed?
In its capital.
And
outside the capital.
And at that point in time, did you know that the Japanese were there?
They were up in what would be in the what they call the summer capital. When we got in, their natural capital, which was a mess all the way around there because you could see houses that had been bombed. And
now, would that have been Manila?
In Manila, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so seeing...
And you could also smell, smell you didn't want to smell.
Now, what would it have been? From bodies or from the bombs, from explosions?
No, from the bodies. They did pour whatever they had with them that they... You know, to with them, but you could still smell it and knew what was happening.
So, did you guys talk amongst yourselves about what you were facing? Do you remember talking about it, or are you just doing what you had to do?
Just doing, following orders. That's what you had to do. That was the you didn't challenge or anything like that.
So, once you're in Manila, did you travel by foot, or were you in trucks, or how did you go?
We had both, trucks and foot, but for the most part it was foot. Actually, we were quite a distance away from their summer capital.
And did you know that that's where you had to go?
Yeah. But at that time it was pretty close to the end of the war there.
And you were hearing that it was...
No, we didn't hear anything, but we knew on the... radio and so forth. Doug was doing a good job.
Doug MacArthur.
Oh, sure.
MacArthur. And
actually, there's a book on him, in the library here. You should read it. I mean, and you'll have a change of thing. You'll be surprised to seeing that the author said he was shy. That's not what the paper said he was.
Had you ever seen him in action or met him?
Eyeball to eyeball.
What was that like? Because he was sort of an icon, wasn't he?
Well, let me say it this way, because I spent quite a bit of time in the Philippines, and He was nothing like the press said he was.
Tell us, for you, what he was like.
Well, he was like any other person that you would see. Harry, that put the pictures downstairs. I gave him pictures of MacArthur when he posed for the GIs.
Oh, here at the library, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you were walking along the street, you know, and he was walking by and you gave him the highball, as we used to say, and he would return it, and he would look and see whether you were just a non, you know, didn't have any stripes or lieutenant or what you were. He called you by good morning, corporal, good morning, parent, and so forth.
And at
evening, or whatever it was.
At that point, what was your rank? In 1945 now?
At that rate, I was a sergeant.
Sergeant.
Yeah. And so one of the things we got the good news when we got there, and we're in his area where he was. There was a whole group of GIs there. Where they were going, I don't know. I asked, nobody went. They were upset. But that was when we woke up that when they left, we had other, the officers, got the groups, see, and put us in different spaces where you were a sentinel, see. And that was all the way around because they had their places down on the other end.
Of the island?
Not on the island, on where we were, down the street. They had the offices, so where they had their woman going in and things like that. And I think the commander-in-chief knew also that they were bringing liquor in there, but he didn't bother with them.
But during the war, the Philippines was a pretty hot spot, wasn't it?
Yes.
And did you face any combat with your unit?
When we went there, that was they were cleaned out of where we landed.
Right.
Okay. In fact, what they were doing was they were putting their things in the place. For example, the where the government lived or worked at that time, they were fixing it because they chased the Japanese right through the thing and they were shooting them, and you could see the scars on the beautiful tables that they had to fix.
That
wasn't mahogany, that was the other type of wood that they had out there. It was the more expensive type of wood if you bought it here. See, beautiful. And made, and nice to sit in and watching it. There were works of art.
Sure.
And walking the tables and the...
And some of them damaged from...
Oh, yeah. Well, our men were shooting to get them out of there.
Sure.
Because they were running away and they were trying to get them.
That was happening as you were coming in?
Yeah.
And then you said you had to go to the summer...
We never got to the summer. We stayed where we were because...
And where was that?
When I said...
out of Manila and...
Right in Manila itself.
Okay.
Right in Manila itself. And in one section, it was quite a big place, see? When I talked about those people that were leaving,
yes,
we were being marched to another place, see? And at that place, we got placed here, there, and everywhere else, all the way around, see? Asked, who's there? Nobody told you, see?
So you were placed as sentinels, you said.
As a sentinel, yeah. And I was at one place. And in the middle of the night or even after that, but anyway, it was dark. But morning came. See, and there's this nice house, you see, and there's gates outside, high gates, beautiful, and going down to the barn. And, I look and say, who the hell lives in this house? Must be someone important if I'm over here, see. And in the morning, you see this Cadillac come in, then I said, boy.
Some VIP.
Yeah, quite a VIP. I look up at the thing to see the five stars around there. I says, oh boy. I said, the commander in chief. And as he come down, I pull up my...
And that was MacArthur.
Yeah, and he gave me the, you know, I come with my rifle, not a gun. Gee, call it a gun, they blow your head off. Mm. And bring it up in the salute way, and he said, good morning. He looked up, he says, I guess we're going to have another Philippine day.
Which meant a beautiful day?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how long were you a sentinel in Manila?
I never counted. We went months in there.
Were there close calls? Were the Japanese still around there? Or?
They had been pushed back. They never come in. In fact, from the time that he said, if you watch the picture where the cameras that went with him on the thing where they were live, where he was in the picture I showed you on this one.
Sure.
Yeah, when he hit the shore, he had an amplifier with him. He says, I have returned. Come to the colors.
But you weren't there at that point.
At that point,
because was that
no, we weren't. Because he was living with his wife and child there, mm-hmm. and he never had his wife with him unless it was safe. And
now, was he? Correct me. Was he with his wife and child in Manila?
Yeah. So not only that, but he also had her in Australia.
Right.
Wherever he went, in fact, when he went to the. The other section there.
In Manila.
In Manila, where the French, the French and other European things, there was another, the Asians were in there, where he went and kicked them out of there. See, he sent a letter to his wife, which is in the book there. You see, he says, in 2 weeks I'll have you over here.
Sure. So did you see direct combat yourself?
We saw the results.
Was that tough for you?
Well, it was what you were looking at is this. You saw beautiful buildings that, were half in the ground and half on the ground and the other half in beautiful, And the same way with the old town that they had when the immigrants went there, of course, the... natives gave him a lot of trouble, so they built a little town in there. This is where the Japanese went in there. They holed up, and of course they had these stones going up, to keep the natives out there. And it ran 16 feet, up. They had to blow that up with 155s, to get in
so
there.
So were you part of that?
No.
Okay.
No. Just to see what, you got the answer of what they see. Look all.
Now, during this time, were there Japanese prisoners around you?
You'll see one or two in that.
But were you part of?
No, they were all rushed in. By the time we came in, things were over. I mean, the Filipinos were out there doing their things, which they couldn't do when.
Trying to get back to business?
Getting back in business, repairing the, getting material, if they could find it to repair, yeah.
Now, so that those watching this know, was this after the atomic bomb had been dropped? That you were in the Philippines?
No, that was after they knocked, that was well after, that was... let's see, even after the other back that we had there, Vietnam, when they dropped that bomb.
No, when the Enola Gay dropped the bomb and it basically ended the war with Hiroshima and that.
That was in Japan.
Right. Were you in the Philippines at that time?
Yes, yes.
Did you hear about that happening?
Well, let's say this, that there was at the center of the Philippines there, where they had the government was in there.
In Manila.
In Manila.
Yeah.
He had his MAGATA had his office there, yeah. Where he worked and so forth. See, and there were amplifiers out there. We were expecting for something. See, and a whole group of GIs around there because the word went around that there was going to end. See, and he came out. And he says, I don't have any news as yet. He says, when I have anything, he says, I'll come out and I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. See? And then he went in and somebody says, oh, yeah. You know?
And then did he come out after to let you all know what had happened?
Well, he didn't, but they announced it that over the thing had come out. It was a big thing. It went all over the damn place. You could, hear. He didn't have to do it.
The noise. You mean the noise of the GIs knowing that everything was
yeah.
done.
Yeah.
So after the Philippines, during that time, were you able to take any kind of what we might call vacation or R&R?
Not
you
then.
Weren't. So the whole time you were gone, were you able to see your wife at all?
No.
You didn't. But you corresponded with letters?
Oh, letters, yeah. Mm-hmm. Letters that they allowed. I mean, they wanted you to write.
Do you feel you were properly trained and equipped for what you witnessed and what you were a part of?
Yeah, in some cases that would happen. And in other cases, you said, go on your own and you could do a lot better, see? And in fact, it was in Australia. I got sent to a school at that time they had in New Guinea to be aware of what the Japanese aircrafts looked like and to go back and teach the outfit just in case.
On what to look for.
And what to look for.
How to identify them.
So I could identify them and you went through that. And then they sent me, that was the first one I went to, and I enjoyed it because those cooks over there, they really knew how to make.
So going to school was sort of pleasurable because you get fed well?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember
the Army, let me tell you, you'd be surprised at how many schools the Army have. Yeah. And somebody's surprised when you say that, so-and-so went to the War College. It's like, War College? Yeah, they got a War College. They learn how to,
For specialties.
Yeah. Yeah, for specialties. And the other school I went to was that notice that the Japanese were getting a little, I don't know how you want to call it, but they had tons of gas to, throw down. And so to go and defend against it,
So you went to school to learn how to do that?
Yeah, on training for what you do. If you even got a smell of gas, you put on your gas mask and stuff like that and be able to know which type it was.
So not only did you have to use your gas mask, but you actually knew which ones might be more potent than others?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, the ones that were not or just one, they let you figure, they put it on your arm and...
You could feel it?
Oh, yeah, no question.
Burning?
Yeah, it was burning.
But you never came into direct...
They never did. They never threw it. It was...
Thank goodness.
Well, because they got a measure that we had more than they had, and we would knock it on them all the way down. So they didn't do it, see? Mm-hmm.
So once you heard from MacArthur and others that basically the war was ending, how much longer did you stay in the Philippines after that?
Let's see, this was in the fall. And sometime into the fall, and they said you would be home by Christmas.
And you were?
Yeah, they promised. I was 25th, I got the date for you then.
Right.
In fact, it was when I was getting ready to leave, see, I was shaving, And I see this face come out, you know, and he's looking. I said, what the hell? This guy is a Barney, you know, he's come from Europe. He's it kept coming and kept coming. All of a sudden, it got tapped. And he says, do you have relatives in Framingham? And I look, I saw it was my cousin.
Really?
He came back from Europe.
He had come back.
Yeah, and he says, how are you going to get home? I says, well, I'm probably going to take the bus. He says, no, don't do that. He says, they're coming down to pick me up. He says, my father, he says, would love to have you know, see you.
So, was this when you were in Boston?
No, this was when we were out in the same camp that we came, we went there. And I forgot what the hell they called it.
Okay.
But it was a place where the Army always, anything had to go with the...
Not Camp Devens.
Camp Devens,
oh,
that
okay.
was it, Camp Devens.
Okay, it's now Fort Devens. It actually is now closed, but okay, you went out of Camp Devens.
Yeah, went back again.
But did you, when you came back from the Philippines, did you come back in through California or New York? Do you remember?
No, we went by boat. I forgot where we went, or by ship. You just call it boat, they knock your head off. We wound up in California.
California.
And from there, they flew us home.
Were you excited about coming home?
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to have a nice time with my wife.
Sure. Well, you missed her, obviously. And while you were gone, did she work?
Oh, sure.
What did she do for work?
She worked in the factory where they made dresses and... For women and girls, and she's good. She still is.
So you were discharged from Camp Devens, Christmas Day,
right?
1945.
Yeah.
At what rank at that point in time?
Sergeant.
Yeah.
Actually, the first time that I was there, I put in for. Going to officer school, see? But stay there a little too long, and they said, well, the next place you could go to, you can do it, see? You can reply, you know, fly again. Never had that opportunity.
You didn't have the opportunity to continue on to officer. So you thought about making it a career?
Well, I might have. I mean, I don't know. It depended on what it was. If you look around, the Army wasn't bad when things were, you know.
When there was no war.
Yeah.
But you made the decision then not to, or you weren't given the opportunity?
Well, when it depended on what you got for the opportunity. As I moved up the grades as sergeant, things got better for me, you see. In fact, I went in, I was nothing but, just somebody that was done. Then I got a stripe, I got a little authority, I got more stripes, and it got better, see?
Yeah.
So if I got the metal on the thing, it would have been better and better. And I might have even, got to the point where I could have gone to West Point. I might have done it if I got back climbing up the thing.
But did you decide at that point to leave the Army?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you had been gone so long, or?
Well, not only that I'd been gone so long, but it was the fact that now I was going home and things were going to be different. In the fact that there was an opportunity there, because by that time the government... stated that all people that were being discharged could go to college if they wanted to go. And I said, well...
So you wanted to use, was it the GI Bill back then?
The GI. Yeah.
So you mentioned wanting to see your wife coming home. When you did come home, did you discuss what you had seen or witnessed during your service and in the Philippines and New Guinea and things of that nature? Did you discuss it with family or friends?
No.
Did you sort of, life goes on, is that the kind of attitude you had, or?
Well, that was what we had all the way along. I mean, when we got noticed that we had to do something, that is, oh, you know, this was, it says, it was always somebody says, look, it's one step closer to home. Sure. So, you know, why you were happy to, you know, do it, see?
When you got home, did you join any unit of the military reserve?
No.
Did you join any veterans organizations, such as the American Legion or any of those?
I joined the veterans organization.
And like VFW?
Then I dropped out.
And you mentioned earlier that you did receive benefits for going back to college.
Well, that's the government
GI
paid for the whatever they charged.
And
I mean, I had to buy my own books, but they
sure.
They can pay.
And you went back to college. You got your law degree?
Had to go be pre-law, see? So I finished that, and it didn't take too long. And, no, wait a minute. I got talked into going to, my wife talked me into, she says, take a couple of courses, see, during the summer. So I did. And I enjoyed it. So in the fall, I signed up. You know, I had all my credits to go to law school. Yeah.
And you went to law school
in Boston?
I
went to law school, yeah, and I graduated.
And did you practice law?
I practiced very well. And the once I got it, I went for training with my uncle, who was a lawyer. He was doing well. And in fact, he did well even during the Depression. He put $10,000 down on the table for a violin, one of those extra special.
And how long did you practice law?
Let's see. I'm still doing it.
You are?
Yeah.
And you said earlier.
Well, I'm not. You know, it's.
You've never really retired.
I didn't retire from it. Okay. In fact, I'm filling my, for my, let's say, 1998. In 1964, I became an attorney. And since then, I've been an attorney, and now on my desk at home, I have to fill out this coming year.
So you have to keep your certification up?
Every year.
Every year.
Yeah.
And what are you, 90 years old now, Joe?
Yeah.
God bless you.
Thank you.
That's great. Do you attend any reunions of your old outfit?
No. They're not in doing it anymore because it was dying out.
But did you attend them?
I didn't because it was mostly going out to the southern area.
What unit were you? Do you remember?
I think it was a 350th something or other.
How important to you was serving in the military?
Well, it was very important. I mean, it was something I figured that I was doing that for my country in appreciation. In the, you know, let me put it this way, my parents were immigrants. And I lived in a section of Boston, well, out of Boston anyway, all kind of immigrants there, see. In fact, I went to Boston English, and it was probably the only, one of the very few schools in high schools in America that took everybody in. Chinese, Japanese, Italians, Irish, you name them. We had it all.
Very
integrated.
Very multicultural, huh? Very integrated.
It was very integrated. As a matter of fact, surprisingly, the most popular member we had in that school, he was Afro-American. Mm-hmm. And eventually he had problems. He would go to summer school and come back again. But he says, I'm going to graduate from it, which he did.
He did.
And he became an alumni, and he also became the president of the alumni association. That's how they loved him.
Sure, sure.
Of course, we had, you know, going to high school, we had some tough guys, you know. They would tell the teacher, I'll meet you downstairs.
They would do that to the teacher. Oh, my.
Yeah, they did. And someone, when he was on the floor, someone says, Henry, didn't they tell you that he was the middle the middle champ high school, college boxer?
Really? Really?
Only lasted one punch.
Do you feel in some way that being in the military affected your life as you got older?
I don't know whether that you always carry it with you, mm-hmm. okay? I think you have the, let me put it this way, that you have that feeling that you always have and had at that time, okay, that it was your country, okay? And the heck with other countries was a feeling that you have. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was your country, do or die, and you had to do it. And even today, I will complain about the fact that in places they don't take the Pledge of Allegiance. And in fact, I went to one of my things there only this year and was surprised that they're very happy that to do it, what they did for the when they were voting on what they were going to do for the year at Wilson School. Yeah.
Oh, at the school.
Well, at the school,
mm-hmm.
yeah. That's the first time I heard it.
Some schools don't do the Pledge of Allegiance, and that's bothersome to you.
Yeah, it is, because it tells us what we are. We have representatives in Washington that talk about our democracy. Well, we're not a democracy. We're a republic. And you won't find that word democracy in our Constitution. And in fact, if you read the 10th essay of Madison, see, he tells you why. He says, democracies start well, but eventually they become mob rule, and what the law is, what the mob wants. And you can see that all over. Here they're talking more and more about our democracy. Even Reader's Digest, there they sent, had a, what the heck, they had people go out there, take what Europe thought about our democracy. They loved it. I said, how could they love our republic? Hmm. They weren't loving anything. That's why I say that even our representatives don't know what in hell they're talking about, see? And so I will tell anybody this, and I'm not ashamed to say it. They do things that are brilliantly stupid.
Hmm. Looking back, are there any memorable experiences or persons or a humorous experience or any of that, one in particular that comes to mind with you?
Oh, there are a number of that, persons. In fact, in one person, there's a picture in there of my friend and a beautiful girl. And he was very much in love with her, but she didn't want, well, of course, it may be that he was Jewish and she was, I don't know what thing she was, but...
Was she in Australia?
Or? No, this was in Florida.
And he fell in love with a girl and...
And, he committed suicide afterwards.
He did?
Yeah.
Do you think it was because of the mix of religion that might have been a problem?
Well, I don't know. I never talked to him after that, in the thing when we all split up. We didn't all go in the same place. That's the...
Could it have been something he also witnessed during the war? Did he have a difficult time?
He never got there.
He never got there?
Yeah.
So it was even before he was sent over?
Yeah. Oh, he was love. She was a beautiful, beautiful girl.
I that mean, had to be difficult for her.
Huh?
That had to be difficult for
her. I don't
her.
Know. I never, mm-hmm. Saw her again or anything. But.
As we finish up this interview, is there anything that you would like to share or anything we haven't asked or a comment you would like to make, not only to your family, but to those who will be watching this tape as you conclude today?
Well, if there is anything I want to say, I think we were, as a country, we were very, very lucky that we had some wonderful representatives who knew what to do.
And
I mean, if you talk to them like Roosevelt, I mean, he did good. You look at our representative like MacArthur, terrific. History's greatest general, as far as I'm concerned. And from then on. But lately, we have people that are representing, not representing us, they're representing the vested interest. They're getting anything and everything they want. I mean, we should go back again, you know? And the other thing is, you get a guy like, what's his name there, fired MacArthur, who was president at that time, and fired him. I mean, just because the president may be the commander-in-chief of the, that doesn't make him a general, see? And had no conception about war.
Would it have been Truman?
Huh?
Truman,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's the other guy that was the got to be a president that was the commander-in-chief?
Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't know anything about war, I mean.
Mm. No. Well, Joseph A. Tedisco, we want to thank you for coming in today and thank you for sharing your story with
us. Well, you're welcome, and that's a pleasure.
Thank you.
And as I told you, I probably won't give anybody else another thing that I've done, you know.
Another interview.
Oh, yeah, I've got about 18 pages of acknowledgments for things that I've done.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.